Welcome to Pathways to Heart podcast series, presented by the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning at Sophia University. Sophia University is located in California and offers students a unique educational experience rooted in transformative, transpersonal education. The Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning supports transformative education by creating engaged leaders and learners through resources, trainings, and events. This podcast series focuses on critical emerging issues in our communities. Today's podcast is a discussion with Dr. Anne Safi Biasetti, sharing an in-depth exploration of embodied self-compassion. Dr. Safi Biasetti is a somatic psychotherapist, certified eating disorder specialist, and a trainer in mindfulness-based self-compassion. She is the author of Befriending Your Body, a self-compassionate approach to freeing yourself from disordered eating. Here, she is interviewed by Dr. Patty Flava.
Welcome, Dr. Biasetti, and thank you for agreeing to this podcast interview. We are so happy to have you here and sharing your expertise. So thank you for taking the time out to be here today.
Thank you, Patty. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here with you and to be in the Sophia community, back in the Sophia community. It really is very heartwarming. So thank you for inviting me.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. Well, your book, Befriending Your Body, which is a beautiful book, by the way. I really enjoyed the book itself and the exercises that it offers. It is a wonderful resource for those in eating disorder recovery, but the information that you share could easily be applied to anyone.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you could share a bit about how you became interested in studying self-compassion, particularly as a means to healing and recovery. What drew you to this work?
Yeah, so, I guess it starts with what drew me even to Sophia, University to begin with, because I was a practicing clinician for 20 years as a clinical social worker. And out of those years, really spent the primary part of those years working with those in eating disorder recovery, disordered eating, trauma, and as well as other diagnoses, And my way of practice shifted a great deal for me through my own personal journey as I discovered alternative forms of healing myself, such as yoga and meditation. And as I discovered more within my own body, and I started, little did I know at the time, acting a lot kinder to myself, right, in my own journey of growth and healing, I decided that I needed to learn more. So it was first through the yoga path that I started, went back and started not only practicing, but then started to learn to become a yoga teacher and then a certified yoga therapist, which deals much more with the mind-body connection. That's actually all we do. And from that journey, I went to my mindfulness training. It was a year-long certification program where practice was a primary learning. It was experiential learning through that certification program. And it was there that we had a whole segment taught to us by Chris Germer. Many of you know Christopher Germer, Dr. Germer, who is the co-creator of the Mindful Self-Compassion Program. So this is before he even started that research and that program with Kristen Neff. And this is that many years ago now. I think it was about back in 2009 or 10. And so he was our teacher on the segment of self-compassion.
Wow.
And as we sat there with him, I know that out of all of the segments that we learned, out of all the areas that we studied mindfulness in, that really struck me. It really struck me. What we were learning about self-compassion and the practice blew me away. The first time that I was guided through metta, a metta meditation, I really felt such a deep, deep moving, right? Such a deep internal shift. And I had to learn more about that. So during that time of the program, I then started attending some retreats, some meditation retreats, and I attended one with Sharon Salzberg and continued to reach out and look for meditation retreats that focused on compassion and loving kindness and the Brahma Viharas. And I just felt an immediate coming home to that practice, like I did when I went for my yoga training too. I felt an immediate coming home to my body. So at that point in time, when the program was over, the mindfulness certification was over, I had a real desire to learn more about what was happening, not just within me, but I was starting to bring all of this into my clients. But there was something that was missing, right? Because here I was, you know, full of love and light, you know, with this compassion. And I would try and bring it to my clients, especially those with eating disorders. And I noticed an opposite reaction. I noticed that they became quite resistant to any self-kindness or the idea of it. They became kind of flooded at times, almost seemed a little re-traumatizing at times. And it was quite upsetting, right? I said, well, my goodness, this is, I know what they need the most. And, you know, even in my book, I write that I took this journey, you know, of healing and recovery when I was, you know, a teenager myself. I didn't have any help at the time. So it was hard for me to say, what did work for me? What didn't, you know?
Right.
All I knew is that in my life at that point in time, that coming into embodiment and self-compassion was a primary shift in my own growth to take it to the next level, which meant for me freedom, like real just freedom in my body, freedom in life, right? Yeah. So that desire to know more is what brought me to Sophia. And at the time, it was still the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. Yes. And I said, you know, I want to learn more. I want to research some component of this. I had no idea still. And that's what brought me there, because I knew I could have the freedom to research and look at a person the way I had started to look at a person, which is through a holistic lens. I no longer aligned with just looking at someone through a diagnosis. And that had changed a long time before that for me. And so I needed to pick a program that was going to be in alignment with the way I saw a person and the way I believed the growth that I believe someone could do, which is more into freedom. And with eating disorder recovery, there's a big divide out in the field. On the clinical lens, there's we look at it much more as an individual diagnosis that unfortunately someone is always stricken by this disorder, right? And on the transpersonal, through the transpersonal lens, as we know, we don't see it that way. You know, right. We see that there is suffering here, but we also know that there's a whole other realm of consciousness that can be tapped into for freedom.
Yeah.
So, you know, when coming to Sophia, it was a lovely invitation to be able to start to explore what I wanted to research. And for any of the folks that may be in that research process now, this is a really great question that one of my professors had given to us at the time when we were in our, it was in our very, for one of our very first classes where we were deciding what to research, and we were using so many experiential methods to get there. Yeah. Who ended up being the chair of my dissertation was Dr. Dorit Netzer. And she, I could talk about the whole podcast just about her. But it was incredible. And one of the invitations that she gave us was through creativity, through art, to begin to explore our topic. And I'll never forget, she said to us at the time, as we were dropping into meditation and then expressive form of what we noticed from there, one of the invitations she had for us was to consider that this is going to be a topic that you will marry, you know, that you will embody, right? That you will take in, that you will be thinking about constantly, that you will be living with, right? You will be breathing it, you will be dreaming it, you will be, right? Depending on what method you choose, you know, if you're like me, where it goes a grounded theory, you will have posters of it all over your walls and everything else. So there was one point I came into the program and I knew I wanted to research something with eating disorders, but at first I was going from, I'm going to call it my old brain, which was, oh, let me pick a very clinical topic such as anxiety and how anxiety, you know, manifests. As soon as she asked us that question and then how does express it through the art form, everything that I saw on that piece of paper was softness. It was soft colors. It was actually one of my animals. It was actually my cat showed up. It was all this, and the meaning making behind that for me. As soon as I saw that picture, I'll never forget her coming around saying, "What do you see? What do you feel?" I said, it's everything that brings me light and compassion. It's everything that brings me compassion. Yes. and I knew, because I had been in a very strong practice by this point, both with meditation and especially compassion-based meditation, I knew what that felt like inside, you know? Yes. Yeah. So when I saw that, that's when I said, wait a minute, that's what I need to know more about. I need to know more about how come my clients can't receive this the way I am receiving this. And I wanted to know the role. That was my research question, right? And my grounded theory was, can you share with me the experience that self-compassion played in your recovery process? So that was my central guiding question. And when I created my flyers to gather my participants, I had an overwhelming response because the question was, do you relate to self-compassion playing a role in your recovery and, you know, self-kindness, being kinder, being gentler, you know, do you relate to this in any way? And if so, would you like to participate in this study? And I mean, grounded theory, you gather quite a number of participants for a qualitative study. So I reached saturation by about 15 participants, but I continued on to 21, I believe it was.
Wow.
Until I really explored the depth of the experience. I kept hearing repetitive themes, you know, like I said, by about 15, but going to that 21 was just really beautiful. And picking a topic that I could marry that way, it was life-changing. It was life-changing to be just immersed in the research, the science of self-compassion, to be immersed in the whole Buddhist lineage of self-compassion, the Brahma Viharas, to be immersed in the practice of it.
Yeah.
And then with these participants and listening to these stories that were just beautiful to hear. And I knew about halfway through, I knew it had to be a book because what I was receiving and from each and every person that shared their journey and what self-compassion did for them was just so rich and so deep. I said, this can't, you know, not that I'm against journal writing. It's just that I knew that this was for the people.
Yeah.
And my fear was that if I just went to write to put it in a journal, that it would never get out to the people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's an interesting take, right? Because if we look at the three components of self-compassion, right, there's self-kindness, there's mindfulness, but the third component is common humanity. Right. And that's, if I look back on it, my own experience of the research was that it brought me into such common humanity, the practice of common humanity. Oh. Yeah, which beautiful. Was, hey, we all suffer. This is the way we all suffer. This is how we heal. It was a collective, you know. And so it made sense to me that it had to become a book to share, to open up humanity, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I love the story of this journey to, you know, with your experience on coming into through art, coming to this realization that shifts the research. How did you come to the realization that self-compassion needed to be an embodied experience as opposed to just a meditative, reflective practice?
Yeah, well, that was really answered by my participants, right? Mm. Because I remember, you know, frantically reaching out to Doreed at the time, because there's nothing like having a central question, right? And then you sit with the first five participants and all five of them tell you, self-compassion was a primary, you know, was a primary piece of my recovery. It was everything. But none of it was there in the beginning. None of it was there in the beginning. And that's what I kept hearing. First person, oh no, I didn't relate to it at all in the beginning. So I was taken aback. And that's what I was experiencing with my clients, right? Is that no, none of them could take it in. But I didn't know where that went, right? I was like, what do you mean none of it was there in the beginning? And I remember reaching out to Dori being like, wow, what do I do with this? My central question is going nowhere, you know? And she said, well, what are you hearing instead, rather than what you're not hearing? You know, what are you hearing? And because, and this is a really important piece, I think, as qualitative researchers, we know how important the role of the researcher is, right? And because I had already done so much healing and so much training through body-based practices, you know, my yoga meditation, the yoga therapy training, which really was so many years of immersion, I was fearful that I would step in too much and wonder about the body too much, right? Because I knew the body was such a central healing component. I was afraid as a researcher that, oh, am I just going to be searching for the body here? So what happened was the first five or six participants, I wasn't seeing it at all. They kept talking about the body. Everything was about the body, but I wasn't seeing it. And so he finally said to me, well, what are you hearing? And I was like, am I allowed to say that I'm hearing about the body? And she's like, of course you are. What are you hearing? And that blew everything open, right? And created all these beautiful questions then that had to do with embodiment, because what I was hearing was, I was hearing really intense suffering. I was hearing things like, I had no kindness for myself. I had self-loathing. I had self-hatred. I had self-criticism. But what I was hearing was, and they would say all those statements, and they would say, and I knew something was wrong in my body. So
there it is.
So as I started developing question after question about that, what that opened up and what I started to hear was that no one could identify it as self-compassion in the beginning, but really what they were saying was something is wrong inside of me. Something is broken. They use that word broken. Every participant used that word broken. Severed, feeling like they were severed from their mind to their body. So they knew there was a disembodiment happening. They just didn't know the word for it. So they knew there was a disconnect, a divide, and they knew that that didn't feel okay. And that, without them realizing the word around that, right? That kind of curiosity and distress even really is a form of self-compassion, right? It's a form of saying, what's wrong with me? I have to find out what's wrong. And what I heard was many people reporting, and this is anyone who works with those that are struggling through this disordering, understand that many people run to the doctor, they run to allergists, they run to all different forms of help, right?
Yeah.
Thinking that knowing something is wrong, but there's a disconnect between, oh, these behaviors that I may be doing are impacting my internal body. And instead, what they're saying is, my body, something's wrong in my body. And the more they feel that something is wrong and they can't figure it out, the more they try and externally control the sensory experience of what's happening within.
Right.
So it was all this, this very, very deep, heartfelt talk about the body. And it was very clear to me that what they were saying was they were disembodied. And right. That was the experience of disembodiment, right? The experience of disembodiment was, I don't know what is going on in here. I can't figure it out. So if we look at it, a lot of my research also, and all my work now actually really dives deep into neuroscience around this, right? Because really what we're hearing someone say is, in the disembodied realm, they're disconnected from their sensory experience.
Right.
And that is interoceptive awareness, right?
Yes.
So on that level, they're saying, I don't know, I can't feel, I can't sense my body, I can't sense what's happening. And it's frightening, right? So they're having a whole internal autonomic nervous system response.
Yeah.
Being disconnected. And if we look at embodiment, we understand that embodiment is the exact opposite, isn't it? Embodiment is completely being connected to the internal sensory experience of our body. It's living life and living in the world with a bodily experience, not just a self experience, right?
Right.
And embodiment leads to a feeling of interconnectedness, both within ourselves and in between, right?
Right.
So in many ways, what I teach now is I teach about how embodiment is actually the healing of the nervous system, isn't it? Both within and in between.
Yeah.
Right? I'm a somatic therapist, so this research really fit beautifully into the work that I do, and I was already investigating.
Right.
And so that was primary. The embodiment was primary. And to understand that, we have to start there. We have to start with helping our clients to embody before we can have them begin to experience what self-compassion is.
That makes so much sense. The embodiment allows someone to hold space for that compassion. It creates the container.
That's right. It's the first foundation, as we know, right?
In mindfulness
and everything else. So it really is, in self-compassion work with this particular population, it really is, we can look at it as the first foundation. You know, we're starting here. We're getting curious about what's happening in here. And the biggest piece, right, because self-compassion in and of itself can be looked at, and I'll say more about this later, but it can be looked at as a responder, right? It's a verb instead of a noun in the recovery process. So it's a motivator, it's a responder. So when someone knows that something is not right inside their body and they respond to it, that's a self-compassionate act, right?
Absolutely. You're
building that from the body. So embodiment was really the grounding of the research. You know, it showed that embodiment was the container, the holding, the grounding of self-compassion.
So if someone is moving toward cultivating a sense of embodiment, what strategies would you employ? What does that process look like to begin to become embodied?
Yeah, so one of the places that I always start, and this is, I think, really central and crucial for the times we live in, especially, is I'll always start with people understanding what led them to be disembodied, right? And we know we live in, and most of us live in a very disembodied culture. And I'm going to say that this is unfortunately probably almost worldwide now, unfortunately, because of our dominance, right? Our Western dominance. And so this duality of mind and body, you know, this paradigm that has been in existence, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, is, I wished I could say that it has lessened, right, through the years as we've introduced practices that are more embodied practices, right? Like yoga and what have you. But, you know, as a yoga therapist, I also understand what have we done to these practices, right? We have embodied. We have taken the mind and the body, and we have separated that, you know, even on the mat, even on the cushion, right? So, unfortunately, we are living in a disembodied culture, right? And we are bombarded with messages constantly about convincing everyone diet culture is a systemic oppression, right, of bodies. And it's a disembodied system. So meaning that what I teach my clients all the time is that this system of oppression cannot even exist if we were all embodied, right? Because embodiment teaches us that I know what my body needs based on what I sense and how I feel, right? I know what it needs. So I don't need a system on the outside telling me the way I should eat, the way I should exercise, what's best for me, the next trend, everything else. So this is a sociocultural impact that is enormous. And I never separate that the intersection of culture from the disordering of what happens in an individual in and with their body and in at the end result, how they're trying to regulate that, how they're trying to cope with that disembodiment. I really find that for the clients I work with, and this is so many years now, over 30 years, so many clients, that they are folks that are longing to come back home. They are folks knowing that I want a deeper connection. You know, embodiment in its whole, right, in its wholeness is about belonging. It's about belonging, right? Feeling a sense of belonging, returning to that home, the way we were all born. Right? So disembodiment is all around us. And, you know, these are clients who, if we can teach them that, so psychoeducation is so important. So if we can start by teaching them about how they lost their way. And the very good reason that they lost their way, the immediate thing we do is we open the door wide open for self-compassion, because what that statement alone, every time I teach that information, my clients like have a sigh of relief. And because what we're noticing happening there is that they've experienced an internal disidentification with the disorder, a disorder that they believed was all their fault. So they've carried around nothing but shame and punishment and criticism. And all of a sudden, when they hear the common humanity of all bodies, now not every body will lose their way in the same way, right? But so not everybody that goes on a diet, let's say, will turn into an eating disorder. But I think the statistics are about 70% will.
High.
It's very high. Very high. And so many of my clients have been, this has been infiltrated into their lives since they were babies, 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old, you know. So when they hear that and we disidentify, you know, they have a disidentification with the suffering immediately by saying, wow, I had no idea this wasn't just about me. I had no idea that this is all around me, impacting me, and that this is how I've been responding to all of this, along with things that went on in my life, genetics and biology, family history, and any trauma and things like that, mood disorders, whatever else may be in the mix, right? So we open up self-compassion through teaching them about disembodiment first, and then about how we were all born a total opposite way.
Yeah.
And so really the recovery journey in the transpersonal view is journeying back.
Yeah.
It's just a journey back.
It's so beautiful. You're describing just this opening of understanding and seeing the bigger picture and seeing that they're not alone. And that experience invites self-compassion naturally, rather than having to say, this is what you have to do.
That's right.
Feel it.
That's right. Exactly. They actually start to express curiosity about their body and about, you know, oh, I see. I've been doing that. Like I've had so many clients that come to discover, you know, they were running, you know, they happen to be running joggers, whatever, runners. And all of a sudden through this journey, they're like, wow, I hate running. They're like, I never liked it. I never liked it. My body doesn't like it. So what's beautiful is you start hearing, I know when folks have crossed in my book is the 9 phases of how self-compassion impacted along the phases of recovery. And about around chapter 4 is the embodiment chapter, right?
Yeah.
And the words you start hearing when people learn what has been happening, right, outside of their body and within their body, when they start learning that, you start to hear different language. People start to say, well, my body didn't really like that. And so it's a lovely relationship that starts to form. And what we're hearing is we're hearing the difference, and this is embodiment again, we're hearing the difference between the subjective experience of being in a body versus the objective experience.
Such a difference. Such a difference.
It has to happen. My gripe with short-term recovery work, unfortunately, and we know that not everyone is privileged to have longer-term recovery work. But I'll also say it's not just a financial aspect that prevents, right? Because I think if we're looking at a systemic interplay here as well, because research has continued to focus just on cognition as a way to resolve and recover. And when we focus just on the mind, well, then what we prescribe is 6-week treatment or 8-week treatment, you know. And so the reason I say that is because we could do this work short term. We could teach people this embodiment work, no problem, and self-compassion work short term. It's just that we have to break through, as we know, even in our research, we have to break through the divide, right?
Yeah.
The reductionism, right? We have to break through the mind-body divide and start to have more research done on methods, you know, on interventions that actually are extremely effective for helping our clients longer term. So even if they're only with us short term, how can we help them longer term? So someone crosses into that subjective view or ownership of the body. Now we're talking self-agency. Yeah. You know, now we're talking empowerment. So it allows them to move to the next step, which is, okay, now that I have this base, now I can turn toward this suffering.
Mm.
And that's where the self-compassion really comes in.
What would you say, and are the most common obstacles that people face when they're really stepping into this work? And what would you recommend for them?
Yeah, so the greatest obstacles are definitely, unfortunately, what they believe their body should be according to the standards that that our culture has set, you know, especially diet culture, the thin ideal. And remember that it's a system that attaches morality and value to size, right? Mm. So that's where it's such an oppressive system. And we can really delve very deep into that too when it comes to race and when it comes to gender and everything else, because that value system goes across the board. So we know that there are so many bodies that are marginalized, even greater, right? So the greatest obstacle is going to be fighting what they start to feel inside, which is, I know what is healthy and strong internally for me, but I'm so scared to face, you know, the repercussions of a changing body and then take that body out into the world where it may not be accepted, or it already hasn't been accepted my whole life. And how do I say that I now know better, right? Mm. When I have believed that I am wrong, you know, my whole life, and that this body is wrong my whole life, how do I now get over that? So, you know, really it's an interplay between, you know, we call it body image, but I like to make it much wider than that. It's so beyond. Body image keeps it stuck on the surface. It keeps it stuck on objectification, which I don't like. I'm teaching a different angle here, right, through embodiment. So it's much larger than body image. It's, you know, it's about the lived experience of a body is what it is. And that's really what we're looking at. So, so I actually have, it's, you know, again, probably beyond our talk today, but I have a whole piece that I'm working on now called Body Forgiveness.
Mm.
And because of this, because this is what clients are up against, this is the obstacle that they're up against once they start recovering through non-harming, right? They're not harming themselves anymore, but now they're left with, I don't know how to live in this body, out in this world, especially based on the messages I've received. Yeah. So body forgiveness is a whole practice that I'm working on now that helps our clients move into a deeper connection, a more sustained self-compassionate connection. Mm. So that's one of the greatest obstacles I'll say that we face. And really it takes a lot of grieving. That's why it's the forgiveness practice. It takes a lot of grieving of what they've received out there. It also takes a lot of grieving of what they've done, because they know they've harmed their own body.
Yeah.
And now they are friends with their body, right? Now they've developed a relationship with it, and that grief is intense, right?
That's big.
It's big. It's a reparative. It's a reparative relationship now. It's like, okay, how do we come to repair this now?
Yeah.
It's tough.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
And you've talked about, you know, this work that you're doing. What are the trainings and programs that you do offer, so that people can find this support? This is really important work.
Yeah, thank you. So after the book came out, you know, I noticed that people were working the book together. You know, they were working with therapists, with dietitians, with each other as friends and all that. So there was that common humanity again.
Mm-hmm.
So very quickly, I think the book was released in August, and by September, I had a small group going. I had a small 8-week Befriending Your Body group going. And that small little group turned into a year-long pilot study that I did, where I collected qualitative data again. Thought I'd never go back to it, but and I did some quantitative as well, because I gave them pre and post tests on self-compassion and interoceptive awareness, and I studied three different groups, and what came out of that was the formation of the Befriending Your Body program. So now I have an 8-week program of making peace with your body, food, and self, and it's an 8-week program where people learn the skills of embodiment. They learn how to embody based on somatic practices that that I offer to them and guide them through, and then self-compassion skills as well for emotion regulation and the continued embodied practicing. So that's an 8-week program that I offer virtually. So I've had people from all over the world. It's, you know, been running strong now for a number of years. I also train therapists and dietitians and eating disorder certified coaches in the work as well. So beautiful. I have professionals training in it. So that's one way. The other way is on my website, and Embodied Life, A-N, Embodied Life. I have a lot of free resources on there. I share a lot of these practices, the meditations, share any of the podcasts that I've done, things like that, so people can gain information. And I will be creating, it's in the works now, a whole separate website just for the Befriending Your Body program. So that is to have a lot more resources and practices that people can tap into. And for people that can't join the virtual program, I have an 8-week online course that they can self-lead, they can do on their own. It's with my instruction. It's just not live, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, so those are some other ways.
Beautiful. That is wonderful.
Thank you.
As we start to wind down here, are there any last minute or closing thoughts that you would like to share? Is there one thing that you would like our listeners to really walk away with understanding about embodied self-compassion?
Yeah, I think the statement that has become a really, really central statement to the program and to this practice of beginning to embody has been this reflection on the statement that whatever it is that you may be blaming your body for, and we all do, right? Mm-hmm. To know that your body never meant to cause you any harm.
That's beautiful.
That if we could just take a breath, you know, together with that yeah. I know it's hard, but your body never meant to give you a hard time. So we start there.
Thank you for that offering. Thank you. And thank you for sharing your story and your experience and your work and your beautiful book, Befriending Your Body. I can't recommend it enough. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For more podcasts or information on educational programs at Sophia University, go to www.sophia.edu. Thank you for listening.